Last week, the book of Exodus, a biographical study of the life of Moses. I encourage you to turn to Exodus chapter 2, which will be our text for today. Now, a man of the house of Levi married a Levite woman, and she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. When she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could hide him no longer, she got a papyrus basket for him and coated it with tar and pitch. Then she placed the child in it and put it among the reeds along the bank of the Nile. His sister stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. Then Pharaoh's daughter went down to the Nile to bathe, and her attendants were walking along the riverbank. She saw the basket among the reeds and sent her slave girl to get it. She opened it and saw the baby. He was crying, and she felt sorry for him. "This is one of the Hebrew babies," she said. Then his sister asked Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and get one of the Hebrew women to nurse the baby for you?" "Yes, go," she answered. And the girl went and got the baby's mother. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this baby and nurse him for me, and I will pay you." So the woman took the baby and nursed him. When the child grew older, she took him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. She named him Moses, saying, "I drew him out of the water." One day after Moses had grown up, he went out to where his own people were and watched them at their hard labor. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people. Glancing this way and that and seeing no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. The next day, he went out and saw two Hebrews fighting, and he asked the one in the wrong, "Why are you hitting your fellow Hebrew?" And the man said, "Who made you ruler and judge over us? Are you thinking of killing me as you killed the Egyptian?" Then Moses was afraid and thought, "What I did must have become known." When Pharaoh heard this, he tried to kill Moses. But Moses fled from Pharaoh and went to live in Midian, where he sat down by a well. Now a priest of Midian had 7 daughters, and they came to draw water and fill the troughs to water their father's flock. Some shepherds came along and drove them away, but Moses got up and came to their rescue and watered their flock. When the girls returned to Reuel, their father, he asked them, "Why have you returned so early today?" They answered, "An Egyptian rescued us from the shepherds. He even drew water for us and watered the flock." "Where is he?" he asked his daughters. "Why did you leave him? Invite him to have something to eat." Moses agreed to stay with the man, who gave his daughter Zipporah to Moses in marriage. Zipporah gave birth to a son, and Moses named him Gershom, saying, "I have become an alien in a foreign land." During that long period, the king of Egypt died. The Israelites groaned in their slavery and cried out, and their cry for help because of their slavery went up to God. God heard their groaning, and he remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. So God looked on the Israelites and was concerned about them. I don't know about you, but whenever I read the story of Moses, I can't help but think of Charlton Heston, Yvonne DiCarlo, and Yul Brynner. And one of my favorite scenes in that movie is when Moses is in Midian, he's out in the desert, and he sees this burning bush, and he goes up to see the burning bush. And I know that this burning bush passage is the next passage, and that Pastor Mike is going to be teaching on that next week. So I really shouldn't say anything about it, but he's not here. So I'll do it anyway. I love how Moses sees this burning bush and he says, "I must go see this wonderful thing." And he leaves, and he looks about 25 when he leaves to go see the burning bush. And a few minutes later, he comes back and his hair is white and his beard is white, and he's aged 40 years in 20 minutes. It's the most amazing thing. And though this miraculous aging process is certainly nothing more than a Hollywood fable offered by Cecil B. DeMille, nevertheless, Moses was no spring chicken when God called him to go back and deliver his people. In fact, he was 80 years old at that time. The interesting thing is that about 95% of the Old Testament narrative of the life of Moses is dedicated to that final 40-plus years of his life. And this chapter alone talks about his first 80 years. And yet, it is impossible for us to have a clear understanding of the man Moses without understanding what happened in these first 80 years of his life. And that's what we're going to dedicate our time to today. I've identified four phases as key phases in this time of God's development of the deliverer of his people. The first phase is the phase of preservation. It's appropriate, I think, on this Mother's Day that this first phase of Moses' life would involve the character and faith of a godly mother. Imagine the horror of a pregnant woman when she has heard the decree that all male children born to Hebrew women are to be taken out immediately and drowned in the Nile. Imagine you are 7 months pregnant, and for months now you have felt the kicks of this little person living inside of you, the result of a loving marriage relationship. Imagine your thoughts. What will this child be? God, let it be a girl. But what if it's a boy? Lord, what can I do? How do I protect him? I can't just give him away to be murdered. I would give my own life first. Moses came into the world to a mother whose love was beyond words. It's the miraculous love that floods the hearts of every parent when he sees his newborn child. And yet now, this love had become a curse. For it would crush her spirit to see her boy taken away and drowned. And so she takes him and she hides him for 3 months. But I imagine she realizes that the cries of a three-month-old child can't be hidden forever. And so she devises a plan. I believe it's her own plan because she seems to organize and carry out the details herself. It's a desperate plan. It's a one-in-a-million chance. And yet it's the only plan she had. Hebrews chapter 11 tells us that Moses' mother knew that it was not the ingenuity of her plan that would save her boy, but that God alone could do that. For Hebrews tells us that it was by faith that they protected Moses. That somehow in the midst of this disastrous situation, Moses' mother believed that God had a plan for him and that God alone was powerful enough to carry it out. And what greater reward from God could this mother find than not only to have her child spared, not only to have her child returned to her so that she might nurture him, but even to be paid for it. And so here we see how God's sovereignty preserves his plan for his people, even in spite of all human endeavors against it. And yet I wonder how often we question God's ability to preserve his plans for our lives. When our plans, our beautiful plans that we've worked out for life, are shaken by some disastrous situation, it's so easy for us to fall into depression or even to lash out against God and say, God, how could you do this to me? How could you allow this to happen? Sometimes we forget that we've been chosen in him. And as Ephesians chapter 2 says, having been predestined according to the plan of him who works out everything in conformity with the purpose of his will, in order that we might be for the praise of his glory. Friends, the only person in the world who can distract you from God's plan for your life is you, by sin. And even sin can be used by God to allow us to give him glory. At the foundation of the Christian faith is a belief in a sovereign God who preserves his plans for his people, no matter what disaster they may face. The preservation of Moses' life was a miracle. And nevertheless, his mother knew that this miracle would only give him to her for a short period of time. Most scholars think 5 years at the most. And it's in these years that she began the second phase of Moses' development. That was his education. And I believe that because she knew that she had so little time, she wasn't worried about teaching him technical things about life. But I think she was worried about teaching him about the grace of a sovereign God who had promised 400 years earlier that he would save his people one day. And I imagine that she told him again and again of the miraculous deliverance of his life and the way God spared him from death. And possibly even whispered into his ear, "Moses, maybe God has chosen you as a special person to bring about his deliverance for his people." Virtually every biographer of the life of Moses believes from their study of Scripture that these few years brought about a formative impact and foundation in the life of Moses that would never be forgotten. Many of us who grew up in Christian families remember the impact of believing parents on our lives. There's an image in my mind that's cemented there that will never go away. The image when, as a child, I would walk sometimes unexpected into my mother's room and find her kneeling next to her bed, praying. And I knew she was praying for me. And as I look back at my family life, I realize that it was the faith of this mother and her faith in God that protected me and that helped me through the traumas that our family faced. And there were plenty. Friends, it's not the world that's going to anchor our children in the faith that they need. And we can't even depend upon the church to give our children their foundation. God's way is for us as parents to teach our children what they need to know, so that they might follow him. But one day, every parent must let their children go. Imagine this mother releasing the 5-year-old Moses into the arms of a pagan princess, knowing that she may never see him again. How will he survive in a hostile world, a world that's hostile to his faith, a world that is hostile to his God, and a world that is hostile to his people? And yet it's not just the mothers and fathers of 5-year-olds who agonize through these questions. It's also the parents of 18-year-olds as they watch them go away to college. It's the parents of 23-year-olds as they watch them get married and move to another city. And yet sending our children into a hostile world is exactly what God calls us to do. He has called us to be salt and to be light in a crooked and perverse generation, and our children cannot do that unless we trust God and let them go into that world on their own. It was into this hostile world that Moses went for the second part of his education, a phase where he would learn skills that he would use for the rest of his life. Imagine the irony that the very man who was seeking to destroy the Hebrew people was in his own house training and giving skills to the Hebrew boy who would grow up and come back to destroy him. It's incredible, God's sovereignty. Moses learned skills like law, military strategy, diplomacy, navigation, and negotiation. And he would use all of those skills. But possibly even a greater education that he received from this hostile world was a different kind of education. I remember when I was in college, I decided to go to Biola College. I'm sorry, when I was in high school, I decided to go to Biola College, to Christian Liberal Arts College in Southern California. And I decided to go there because I felt that I wanted to go into full-time Christian ministry. My brother couldn't figure out why I'd want to choose such a vocation, since that was not on his heart, nor the ways of God. But he decided he'd give me a piece of advice anyway. My brother was a graduate of the University of California at Berkeley. which was, needless to say, not a bastion of conservatism in the 60s and 70s. My brother said, "Brad, you need to go to Berkeley, because if you're going to fight sin, you've got to experience sin." My brother was being facetious, but there's a way in which my brother was very, very right. For you see, I believe it's when Moses was taken away from his godly family, placed into this very different world, that he was able to see the vast difference between the ways of God and the ways of men firsthand. It was in the palace that he saw the depth of corruption that would come from total power, total wealth, and total idolatry. And in being fully immersed in a world without God, Moses saw that he had to make a decision to put his faith into action, which brings us to the third phase of his development, the phase of dedication. In verse 11, we're told that Moses went out to where his people were, and he watched them at their hard labor. The Hebrew expression here means that Moses saw them and he felt grief. He felt stricken as he saw his people under their labor. And it was at this point that Moses made a sacrificial decision of monumental proportions. Turn with me to the book of Hebrews chapter 11 for just a moment. Where we have another commentary on the life of Moses at this stage. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 24. "By faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He chose to be mistreated along with the people of God rather than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a short time. He regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as of greater value than the treasures of Egypt, because he was looking ahead to his reward." First, we have to look at what Moses turned his back on. Certainly, by turning his back on his adopted heritage, he turned his back on an office of power in the kingdom of Egypt. An office maybe not unlike the office held by his great forefather Joseph, who was the prime minister of Egypt. Moses turned his back on that. Not only did he turn his back on a position of power, but it says he decided not to enjoy the pleasures of sin. Moses was in an environment that would allow him to indulge himself into anything that his heart desired, to the limits of his lust, and to enjoy it. And Moses decided not to enjoy that sin. But it's not just what Moses turned down that's important, this enticing society. But I think it's even more important that he turned to embrace a future with many disadvantages. Future that would be a future of slavery rather than of power. Disgrace rather than respect. Pain and sorrow rather than luxury and ease. He regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as of greater value than the treasures of Egypt. I believe this right here is the key moment in the entire life of Moses. For it's at this time that he made a decision of dedication and commitment to God from which he would not turn back. And I submit to you that the decision that we make to follow Christ is very, very similar. I spend plenty of time with believers who are suffering. And often, they're suffering because of painful circumstances in their lives, circumstances of great frustration and sometimes disaster. And I would say first off that I believe that Christians need to be allowed to feel suffering. They need to be allowed to feel sorrow and pain and grief and even anger at situations of great difficulty. Even Christ himself felt these things. But sometimes it seems that believers in their difficult times feel like, "This isn't what I signed up for. when I cast my lot with Jesus Christ. Sometimes I have those feelings myself. But friends, this is exactly what we signed up for. In the Gospels, Jesus stresses to his disciples that to follow him means to embrace pain and suffering. He said to them, "If anyone would come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross daily, and follow me." I think sometimes we tend to look at our faith as something that's supposed to relieve us from hardship, relieve us from stress, keep us away from disaster, and protect us from the things that would hurt us. And indeed, there are many ways in which it does do that. For it lifts the guilt of sin, and it brings the joy of a relationship with Jesus Christ. But Christ himself also asks us to embrace the cross, which is an instrument of suffering and torture. And he asks us to carry it every single day with us. I believe this is the foundational decision of true Christianity. Not a lighthearted decision to be friends with Jesus, but a decision to turn our backs on selfish pleasure as top priority, and instead to embrace Christ in his suffering and his pain, because he is the way, the truth, and the life. And no peace, love, or even God himself can ultimately be found without this decision. It's in this decision that Moses dedicated his life once and for all to God. But as is often the case, a great decision to dedicate one's life towards God, in the case of Moses, is followed by a foolish, disastrous decision of immaturity. Moses' decision was so strong that he would kill for it. And indeed he did. Acts chapter 7 tells us that Moses' decision to kill the Egyptian was done from good motives. But it was a bad decision. It was a decision to do things his way rather than God's way. A decision to use his power rather than God's power. It was a decision of brutality rather than righteousness. Not only was it a decision of brutality, but it even completely failed in its intent. Here is Moses who looks at his decision and he says, "I'm going to step out and help my people. I'm going to do something powerful to help my people." And I'm sure he's thinking in his mind, "Now they're going to begin to see me as their deliverer." But what happens is the very opposite. And they look at him with fear and with disdain. Not only is he failed by his people's view of him at this point, but then he's kicked out of Egypt to a place where he can do nothing. Now imagine Moses may have hit bottom at this point. Here's a guy who has made the most sacrificial decision of his entire life. He has said, "God, I'm giving up everything for you, and I'm embracing all of your suffering and your pain and your people. Here I am, and I'm going to save your people." And now God not only turns his own people on him, but he takes him to a place where he can't even do anything. "God, I don't understand. Now I can't do anything. If I had stayed in the government, at least I could have helped your people. Now I can do nothing." Which is exactly what Moses needed to learn. That without the power of God, in his own strength, he could do nothing. Moses needed to grow up. He'd started off in the right direction, but he needed to go into the final phase of his development. And that's the phase of maturation. Becoming mature in his relationship with God. Moses had some important lessons to learn, and I believe the first one was learning something about God's way of delivering people. He comes upon, early in this stage, a new opportunity to deliver people. Here are these girls who are shepherding their sheep, and some male shepherds come in around the well and they chase them off. And Moses irresistibly steps into the situation to be again the deliverer of the righteous and the oppressed. But notice the difference. There's no sign of violence here, is there? Instead of seeing Moses the murderer, we see Moses the servant who comes in and calmly takes the women's sheep, draws water for them, something a man would never do in that culture, and feeds their sheep for them. No macho display of power, but instead a display of God's power through servitude and through humility. He allows God's power to be displayed rather than his own, and the result is not disdain and fear, but instead it's appreciation and respect. Moses begins to learn at this point that true deliverance comes through the power of God, not through his own power. A lesson that Moses will need to remember when he goes back to Egypt. Beyond this, Moses' desert exile is the perfect place for him to mature in some other ways. Moses the prince becomes Moses the desert worker, learning probably for the first time in his life the discipline of hard labor. Moses the ruler of men becomes Moses the ruler of sheep, finding out that he had to care for an animal that will walk off into stupid situations and destroy itself without sacrificial and powerful leadership. It wouldn't be too many years before Moses would be leading a group of people who were not unlike those sheep. Moses, who was uniquely at home with all of the cultures of Egypt, with the powerful as well as the oppressed, became separated from his own people and lived with people whose ways that he did not know. And I believe it was that time that taught Moses how to depend upon and cling to God. One of the great experiences of my life was when, after college, I decided I wanted to go to Europe. And in fact, it was since the sixth grade that I had wanted to someday go and travel Europe and see its great culture and its rich history. And so after college, I took a year off from school and I worked and made a bunch of money and put on a backpack and flew over to Europe by myself and backpacked around Europe for 3 months. And it was one of the most fantastic experiences of my life. Yet in the midst of all of that, it was a time of great loneliness. Night after night spent by myself or spent with people that I didn't know. But it was in that alienation that I found a new depth in my relationship with God. Because every night I was by myself and I would open His Scripture and God would show me new things about His relationship to me that I hadn't seen before. And when I would be standing in front of some of the greatest sights in the world, there were people all around me, but I couldn't talk to them because none of them spoke my language, and I didn't know them anyway. And so I began to share those experiences with God and just talk to Him about Him and share my joy with Him. And it was in that time that I began, for the first time I think in my life, to really experience the daily presence of Jesus Christ in my life. I believe that out of Moses' loneliness was in this place that he began to develop a deep understanding of the presence of God in his life. Finally, Moses had the opportunity to learn one of the greatest lessons of life, patience. And his teacher was a simple one, but very effective, time. Scripture tells us that Moses was in the desert for a long time. Indeed, it was about 40 years. He was 80 years old when God called him to return to Egypt. And to human eyes, Moses' exile was a waste of the prime time of his life. But God could do greater things with an old man who was spiritually mature, who was ready to be used, than with a young man who did not yet understand the ways of God. Moses was now ready to hear God's voice. He was ready to walk God's way. So what can we take away from this narrative of 80 years of Moses' life? I want to make a suggestion. But first, walk again with me through these phases of Moses' life. In the time of his infancy, how was it possible in the midst of this disaster that the baby Moses would be preserved? Could godly parents protect him? Was there any plan that was a surefire plan to save him? No. But the sovereignty of a God of grace, enacted by the faith of a godly mother, was able to snatch Moses from death. Could the few years of godly principles in the early stage of Moses' education, barely remembered by this young man, deliver him from the clutches of a world that would tempt him and entice him? Not by itself, but the grace of a sovereign God allowed Moses to remember them and to follow God's ways. Could Moses heal the wounds of a disastrous mistake, of a murder? No. The power of God could cause Moses to recover from the greatest mistake in his life. Could a desert of exile and despair bring Moses to a place of maturity? Only if it was accepted as the will of a sovereign God who chooses sometimes to use suffering to cause us to embrace Him more fully, and who has a plan for our lives, for a future, and for a hope. What fearful or unconquerable circumstance do you face in your life right now? What desert of frustration and despair do you find yourself in? There may be no human answers. If you've lost your job, you might not be able to do anything about that. If your spouse is distant from you, you may not be able to do anything to help it right now. If your children are on drugs, you may not be able to stop them. But I believe that none of those things are the point, even though sometimes they seem like the all-consuming point of life. The main point is that there is a sovereign God of grace who calls us to trust Him in times of crisis and despair. And in those times, He may sovereignly choose to change your situation, or He may choose to leave you in the desert for 40 years. In any case, He wants you to decide to walk His way wherever you are and to trust Him for the rest. Only in so doing, in trusting God's sovereignty wherever we are, can He mold us into the beautiful pieces of workmanship that He's created us to be, in His way and in His time. There's a song I want us to sing together. It's called In His Time, and it's on your blue sheet. Think about the difficulties that you're facing right now in life, the challenges that are before you, some that may seem insurmountable. And as you sing this song, realize that it's a God of love and of complete sovereignty who has you there, and who alone, by His power, can bring you through.